station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Catch Them Doing Something Good on Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. Every Monday from 11 a.m. Pacific time to noon, my guest and I will bring you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. My guest today is Davey Chandler, the clinical director at Sunhawk Adolescent Recovery Center, and I certainly caught him doing some things really good. Davey's work at Sunhawk involves supervision of the clinical department, which consists of the therapist and the nursing staff. He received his Master of Social Work degree from the University of Utah and immediately began providing intensive individual and family psychotherapy. What he doesn't publicize enough is the great work he and many others, Bikers Against Child Abuse, do for our young people. In his bio, Davey states he is married to the most incredible woman on the planet and has five amazing children. I think the last statement is the most rewarding and the one I and most anyone else wants to be able to honestly say. Maybe not the same amount of children, but but I think that's the one that we would love to be able to say. Davey, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And one of our other surprises, and Davey, I'll have you introduce her, is that person he's describing as the most incredible woman is here with us.
Well, she is, and she didn't know that she was going to be here, much less on the air with us, but have the good fortune of having the greatest source of inspiration in my life with us today. And Raven is here in the studio with us, so I'm very happy that she's here. Thanks for being here, Raven.
Thanks for letting me be here today.
Well, I appreciate it. Now, tell us a little bit about this man, something else we don't know.
Well, what I have to say is that he is truly my hero. To watch him with children and with people and helping them to understand how important they are and to watch how much he loves people and takes care of them is amazing. And to watch him with our children and the ways that he is able to help them learn and grow and engage and help them to realize their potential and what good people they are is just amazing.
Well, and that's why I said I look at this as a Catch Them Doing Something Good edition, because the people that I've spoken to, and not just some of the parents that of the kids that we've brought to your program, but someone like Jeff that we were just talking about, could not say enough wonderful things about you. So I'm glad to be able to do this, because one of the things that I have said all along is that in our media, we have too much of a focus on the negative things that go on out there. And so part of my job is to catch people like you doing something good. And that's the information I want to get out. So now that I've caught you, let's get started. And I think probably the best way to start is, tell us a little bit about Sunhawk, or, you know, tell the audience a little bit about Sunhawk, what it is that they do, and what part you're playing in it.
Well, I have to say I'm really glad to be here, because it is doing something good. It's doing a lot good. Sunhawk Adolescent Recovery Center is exactly what the name of the place says. We're an adolescent recovery center. We specialize in working with adolescents between the ages of 13 and 18, which means really we work with kids between the ages of 14 through 17 who struggle with substance abuse and addictions. All the kids that are there are kids that have had substance abuse problems and addiction problems, and we're there to work with them in some unique ways and some common ways, but to work with them to get through those addictions and to be able to lead happy, normal lives.
What kind of interventions do you offer?
The primary intervention that we offer is using group work and the 12-step model in a pretty intensive way. There are a lot of programs out there that say that they use 12 steps and that say that they use group work and that say that they do substance abuse intervention, but when we say we do it, we mean we really do it. For example, we have over 30 hours of group work that we do per week with the kids.
Wow.
And that's a lot of group work. And when we say we do the 12 steps, we mean that we're pretty intensive in how we do those 12 steps.
I've been out to a lot of programs, and I know that, you know, a lot of them, you know, will have AA or NA meetings. How many do the adolescents attend each week in your program?
The adolescents attend 7 AA or NA meetings a week, including off-campus meetings. When they hit second level, they're allowed to go off-campus and encouraged and, in fact, required to go to off-campus AA meetings in addition to the AA and NA meetings that we have on campus.
Now, do they have to reach a certain level to be able to go off-campus?
That's correct. Yeah. When they first come in, we don't allow them to go off-campus, and that's a safety and
sure. Security
reason for that.
being the transport person, I certainly understand that part.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, let's talk a little bit about the staff. I mean, what sort of substance abuse training does the staff have?
You know, typically in our industry, I'll kind of come around to that, there's a lot of turnover in the staff, and we're fortunate that the staff that we have are really committed to the work that they do. They really have a vision of what we do and why we do it. So about 50% of our staff are in recovery themselves, and all of the staff receive some pretty intensive training about substance abuse recovery and about the 12 steps. So this isn't just a bunch of people that are there to babysit the kids. These are people that are active in their own recovery and in their own treatment. They really want to help these kids get better.
Now, talk a little bit about, because I know that other people have brought it up, and I think of even going back to my day, the scared straight things and stuff like that. Explain the difference in how the kids respect or approach that when they're dealing with somebody who maybe has gone through some of the same things versus somebody who hasn't. Let's talk a little bit about the psychology behind that.
Well, the real psychology behind that is a positive psychology. It's interesting that the name of your program is Catching People Doing Something Good. That's really what we're about there. We have an underlying philosophy that says that light is more powerful than dark. And so we want to help these kids discover their light, and the staff are trained to do that. We have a positive reinforcement system, a positive peer system, where the kids and the staff are all trained to catch each other doing things well. They receive points, positive points, for doing things well. When they do their chores, when they do their hygiene, when they do the things that are expected of them, they get points. Their ability to work through the level system depends on them getting a certain percentage of their points.
So are you saying that even the kids that are in the program, if they catch somebody else doing something good, essentially they're both going to get points?
What happens is that oftentimes that's true, but what really happens is that in the group system they call each other out positively, or if somebody's not doing what they need to do, then they'll hold that other student accountable for that and may call them out. And so what happens in those groups, in those real intensive groups, is that they really are able to hold each other accountable, both positively and in the absence of some of those positive things, to work with each other and say, you know, you're saying all the right things, but we don't think you're really getting it. We want you to go deeper. Those words are always there in the groups. We're always hearing the kids tell each other, go deeper with that, go deeper with that. And as they do that, it may not be the actual numeric points that are given, but they start to understand each other and they start to build each other and relationships are formed.
Right. And what I hear you saying is that you've established a really good positive peer culture. How do you maintain that? And coming from someone like me, I'm bringing in kids who may not have that same positiveness when they're first coming in. How are you getting them to become, to grasp it quickly so that they can't become sort of a negative effect on this positive peer culture you've established?
It's a real important point that you make, Alan, because most of the kids that do come haven't had positive feedback.
Right.
What they have had is a lot of negativity. Our society is kind of set up for that. Society isn't apt to reward us for doing things well. They typically call attention to what we don't do well. And so when they come into our treatment center, they're not accustomed to having people pay attention to what they do well. And it takes them a while to get used to it. They don't believe it at first. But as they engage with their other peers, and it's not just staff that are paying attention to what they do well, but it's their friends. It's the people that they're in the rooms with that are calling that out. They really start to believe that. And the transformation is remarkable. when you see these kids that have been so beat down start to see their own light and start to share that light with each other, mm-hmm. and start to see the truth of who they really are, it truly becomes miraculous.
Well, and we see that also even from the standpoint, you know, from their bedroom at 5 o'clock in the morning, we will see that. And there's been many times in which I'm talking to the child, and once we've explained the entire situation, and I've said, I need you to give me three promises. You know, one, that you won't do anything to hurt yourself, you won't try to do anything to hurt us, and you won't try to run from us, because potentially that could cause you to get harmed. And they've agreed. And we've gotten up and we've walked out, we've gotten in the car, and I've had them say, "Are you an idiot?" And I go, I'm sorry, I certainly could be, but for what particular point are we trying to go now? And they said, "You have a whole file on me. Didn't they tell you that I lie?"
Right.
And I go, "Well," I go, "I'm looking at the file." I said, "Have you ever lied to me?" He goes, "Well, no, I just met you." And I said, "Then why would I assume that you're a liar?"
Right.
And that, I think, is that first step for them starting to think about, wow, you know, I'm getting a fresh start.
Yeah.
And I think that's the important thing, again, as they're going into the program and into that culture, is, wow, these people aren't judging me. They aren't assuming that I'm going to do all these bad things. And I just think that's great. I mean, I think that's such a key thing in these situations.
So
that's,
what you're doing is giving them an opportunity to choose different and go, well, maybe I can do it different.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's great.
Yeah. And well, because what we want to be doing is we want to start preparing them for what they're going to see when they get to the program.
Exactly.
And if they have that versus a situation of somebody who just tries to physically restrain them and says, look, I'm reading something that says that you lie, cheat, and steal, so I'm going to treat you just like that. Well, you know, that's to me making your job tougher, because this is another outsider who's just assumed all the things that was said in here is exactly what everybody's going to believe. So to me, we're retarding your process. We're starting, you know, we're saying, okay, we're going to set them back a couple of weeks before you get them.
Yeah.
As opposed to giving them something positive to where it's almost like they can, no pun intended, hit the ground running, but right. not running away.
Right. Right. Yeah. Alan, I think that's a real important point, because we don't believe that the kids are bad.
Absolutely.
We believe that these are kids that have some problems, and that the symptoms that they're showing, the lying, the cheating, and the stealing, those aren't really the problems. Those are the symptoms of other problems. But we believe that these kids are kids that are fundamentally good, that have that light within them, and that if we can help them find that light and express that light and recognize mm-hmm. that light within themselves, then they'll begin to express that with each other and within themselves. And it's incredible what happens when they do that. And when they recognize that within themselves, they want to be that light with each other. And it's absolutely phenomenal what happens with them.
Yeah, and actually that kind of reminds me of another story. But obviously we travel with these kids, and I have shirts that say, you know, that say the company name on it. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting on an airplane, and this woman keeps looking at me. And I've done some shows on television and stuff, so sometimes people will recognize me from that. And this woman looks at me and she goes, I know who you are. And I went, yeah, okay, you know, and she, no, really. She goes, I know who you are. She goes, you're that guy that takes those bad kids to those programs. And I looked at her and I said, excuse me, I'm sorry, but I'm not. And she goes, oh, yeah, I saw you on TV. You're that man. I said, no, I'm that person. I said, I'm the guy that takes good kids that have made some bad decisions to programs that are going to help them.
Right.
Wow.
But unfortunately, to some people, that's the perception that they have.
Yeah.
And if you continue to project that onto the kid, guess what?
Exactly. You know, you talked about what techniques we use and what methods we use. And one of the, and this kind of is a segue into that, one of the real cornerstones of what we do is the use of spirituality. And the 12 steps are a real spiritual approach. And I think that that's the primary reason that we use that. There's lots of other reasons. There's a continuity of care reason, that you can find a 12-step group and an AA group pretty much anywhere you are. And so we have almost a guarantee of a continuity of care when a student leaves our care. But the biggest reason we use that is the spiritual aspect of it. And people always go, oh, wait, the kid's going to Utah, he's going to turn him into a bunch of Mormons.
That was exactly what my question was going to be, because when I talk to the parents and they've talked to an ed consultant, the ed consultant has recommended, you know, a program in Utah.
Right.
And the parents, I guess for some reason they don't want to ask the ed consultant this, so they ask us before we come pick them up, and they go, you know, I know the program's there, but they're not going to turn them into a Mormon, are they? You know, so I it's good that you're talking about that, and if you can explain the basic spirituality
right.
of it, I think that'll help some of the parents that are listening that have that very question.
It really is. There's a huge difference between spirituality and religiosity. Mm-hmm. And we don't talk about religion. The kids talk about religion from time to time with each other, but we don't talk about religion. And the two concepts don't have to be exclusive of each other, but they're certainly not the same thing. What we talk about is spirituality. When the kids come in, when they have an experience with each other, when they go out and they do service work, and we do a lot of service work, when they go out and they perform or they do some service at an old folks home or at the homeless shelter or all the different aspects of service that we do, and they leave there and they experience something, or they go to the library and they read to the little kids there, and they come out and maybe some of them have got some tears in their eyes or things like that, and we'll hear the kids say things like, man, that's better than any high I ever got.
Mm-hmm.
It was stopped.
Oh.
And we circle up and we go, okay, what is that? And they'll talk about it and we go, that's spirituality.
Yeah.
Or we'll be out on a camp out or we'll be out on a hike and the kids are going, wow, you know what? I remember this. I remember being out on the beach and I remember looking up at the stars and I remember having this feeling. And we'll stop and we'll circle up and we'll go, that's spirituality.
Right.
What's that all about? And we start talking about it. So the kids get a very clear understanding what spirituality is and how powerful it is, how profound it is, and what they need to do to get it, and how service to each other and to others is how you go about it.
Mm-hmm.
So they understand how powerful this feeling of spirituality is to them, how much they want it, and what they need to do to get it, and that it's real. It's not artificial.
Well, and that's great, and I'm glad that you've explained that, because, again, you know, dealing with parents from different religions, you know, for them to understand that and understand that that child's going to come back, they're going to come back with a basic spirituality that is probably going to be tied to whatever religion they went there with.
Right.
You know, and I think that's the beauty of it. Now, I would imagine that that's one of the guiding principles, and because I know a little bit about Sun Hawk, and I know you have 12 guiding principles, what are some of the other guiding principles that the families can kind of expect that their children are going to go through?
Well, some of the guiding principles have to do with the 12-step approach. It has mm-hmm. to do with service, and those are the main ones. I mean, we could go through the whole list of 12 principles that we have, but it's probably more important to really look at the underlying issues behind those 12 principles, and those 12 principles are the 12 steps, community service, but also just service as a whole. It's not always community service. It's service to each other. It's service to oneself. It's service to the family. It's knowing who they are as a person. It's seeing the strengths and the beauty that they have, the light that they have, the light that they can share with each other. So all those principles have to do with understanding the truth of who they really are, as opposed to who society or the drugs or the alcohol have led them to believe that they are. It's rewriting those scripts mm-hmm. that they've been saddled with through their lives.
Okay, well, and let's talk about another portion of it, which is the academic portion. Sure. A lot of parents, if their child is going off to a program, one of the concerns is, well, wait a minute, they're already 6 months behind in school because they haven't been going.
Right.
Does the program offer a full academic credit? And in many cases, can the kids get caught up?
Yeah, it's one of the kind of phrases that's come out is credit reclamation, which is kind of an interesting phrase to use, and it's really possible to reclaim some of the credits that the kids have lost. We are fully accredited high school through the, I believe it's called the Northwest Association of Accredited Schools. Kids can actually graduate from our program, and we've had a number of kids leave our program with a high school diploma. We've done school a little bit different. We do school in the afternoons now. We actually okay. start school at 3:30 in the afternoon and go until about 9 o'clock at night, which some parents and other people go, well, why do you do that?
That's exactly what I was thinking. Why do you do that?
there's a whole bunch of reasons for it, and the biggest reason is that we found that it works so much better. It works better for us logistically, but it works a lot better for the kids. It's difficult to have a kid during the day leave a classroom, go into a therapy session and talk about really deep issues, or have a family therapy session that might go a little bit tough, and then go back into a math class and be expected to perform academically.
That's a good
point. Just doesn't work. And so we're able to separate that out. So most of the treatment takes place during the day, and then the school takes place during the evening.
But it's all on the same campus.
That's correct. And all in the same location. So school takes place in the afternoon and the evening, and the kids are settled down more, and it just works a whole lot better for them. There's a lot of research that shows that adolescents are a little bit more nocturnal than they are diurnal, and so it works better for them to focus, and they do a lot better in the afternoons and evenings. In addition to that, we have core classes on campus. We have all the kids go through PE during the day. We have the humanities teachers there on campus, and some other teachers and classes that are done right there. But most of the core classes, the mathematics and some of the other social studies and things like that, are actually done online. And so we work with a program online that is actually able to tailor an educational program for each individual student and where they're at. And so we don't have one math teacher in a class with kids that some are doing pre-algebra and others are on a trigonometry level and trying to teach to the level of everybody in that classroom. So we're able to take each student and essentially come up mm-hmm. with an individualized academic plan for each one of those students individually, and they can work at their pace and at the level that they're at, and in so doing be able to get caught up in some really amazing ways.
I was going to say that makes great sense, because I think a lot of the issues come out of the fact that if you have somebody who, because they have allowed themselves to get behind, and we see it in a lot of kids, to where they just give up. They go, "What's the use?"
That's right.
You know, what's the use of pushing through, because I'm so far behind now that I'm never going to dig out of this hole. So I like that, to be able to set it up specifically with what they can handle, because I think the other thing is that if you do try to rush them up, but they're in a whole classroom, if they're embarrassed by the fact that they are so far back, now they're still going to crawl in their hole.
It just beats them down further.
Yeah.
And this gives them an opportunity to be really successful, which again helps them feel better about themselves. There's more positive reinforcement when they see themselves doing better, and they get to write home and talk to their parents at home and say, "And look at me, I'm doing great academically." And they're getting A's and B's instead of D's and F's, and their parents are encouraged by that, and they're encouraged by that. It builds their self-esteem. They feel good about themselves, and once again, they're more able to see they're liked.
Now, can the parents track that online?
Absolutely. We have a program called Parent Check-In. They can see where their students are at any
point.
So
they can see the growth. They can actually go online and see that he's getting C's, he's getting B's, he's getting A's, or whatever. They can see that, which I think is really good for them, because a lot of the parents are scared when their kids have gone away, and there's this fear of, I don't know what's going on. And I just talked with a parent recently, and they said, "I cannot believe, you know, that I'm making this decision. It is the most difficult decision I've ever made in my life."
Right.
"And every day that they're not here, I'm anxious."
Right.
So I think having that sort of a lifeline, that connection to where they can see growth, I think it's great.
And Alan, that's an important point to make, because so often the parents will send their child away to a treatment program and they feel outside of that, and they feel left out, and they don't know what's going on, and that is so difficult to do. That decision to send your child to treatment is just extraordinarily painful. So we at Sunhawk Recovery Center do an awful lot to bring the parents into that treatment process. So weekly there are family therapy sessions.
Okay.
We have telephonic contact between the student and their parents once they reach a level 2. We do family therapy sessions on the phone. The parents are brought out to Sunhawk Adolescent Recovery Center for parent workshops
mm-hmm.
That focus on the treatment process so they understand what's going on. There's a transition workshop that they go through once the student is preparing to go home, so that they can address the concerns about the student coming back home or to a step-down program or whatever comes next. So our family piece is really, really important.
I agree, and it actually reminds me of a little thing that I do sometimes. And many times we will get a call in regards to transporting a child, and then it gets changed, and then now it's not going to happen. And then I'll talk to the professionals involved, you know, that will say, "Well, you know, one parent or the other seems to keep bailing."
Right.
You know, they get right up to the point of making the decision, and then And in my terminology, they sabotage it.
Right.
You know, either they tell the child too soon, the child runs away, and then by the time the child comes back, the one parent's trying to convince the other that maybe we shouldn't do it. And what I've learned to do over the years is, in that case, when I've talked to the professionals and I've said, okay, look, this is the same kid. This was 4 months ago. We were trying to do the same thing, and everything kept happening. I said, I need to get both parents on the phone at the same time, you know, as we set up the transport, and I get them both on. And I steer the conversation, because almost every parent will want statistics of success.
Right.
They'll go, okay, well, look, you're not really tied to this program, so how good is this really is? I mean, what's the percentage? I mean, what's the chance my child's really going to come out? I go, you know what, that's a great question, and I'm so glad that you asked it. I said, because let me tell you. I go, except for those times in which one of the parents sabotages it, The percentages are really, really high, because I went through a period of time in which I contacted 600 past clients, and we talked about what was happening now, you know, 2 years later, where are they at, what are they doing? And I said, then it was incredible, the percentages of how well they were doing.
Yeah.
So I'm talking to these parents, and they're all pumped up, and I'll say, but you know, the thing is, and let's say, for instance, the professional involved has said that there's a particular way that this one person sabotages. And I'll say, you know, so as long as nobody sabotages, but let me share with you some of the ways in which they do that. And I share about five different ways. Well, the middle one is usually the one that I know that one of them is doing. And I just share this and I go, as long as this doesn't happen, your percentages are really, really great. And, you know, I never shine a light on one person in that conversation. Well, there's been many times in which afterwards I've gotten a call from the non-saboteur parent that has said, are you psychic?
Yeah.
Why would you ask that? And they said, well, because my spouse, they keep doing that. One of those things you said, they do that and so on. I go, well, glad I could help. You know, don't want them to feel they were set up or anything, but, you know, just... We're doing what we can to help them get to the program, because if one of you keeps sabotaging, they're not going to get there. And if they don't get there, they're not going to get the help.
That's right. And you're absolutely right. Having both parents on board and having the parents on board just from the start is so important. And that's a tough piece. When a parent sends a child to treatment, in essence what they feel, I think, and sometimes it's unconscious but sometimes it's conscious, is they feel that I have failed. And so if they send a child to treatment and we succeed, then it means that they really have failed.
Mm-hmm.
If, on the other hand, if we fail, then it means that they weren't such big failures.
Right.
So I think sometimes there's an unconscious agenda to have us fail. Well, if we can help the parents understand that this isn't about their failure,
right.
If we can help them understand the dynamics of addiction, if we can help them understand what's really going on, and understand what they can do to join in this process of treatment, then we can disabuse them of that conscious or unconscious notion that they have, that they have failed.
Exactly.
If we can help them understand that, in fact, sending their child to treatment is this colossal act of love and selflessness, and that act in and of itself that makes them some of the best parents that exist on the planet, now we're a team. Now we can work together. And we're not the enemy. We're not the ones that are trying to make them look like bad parents. And now we can work together to help them. And I've found that in and of itself is an absolutely critical part of helping these kids get better.
You're right. And I couldn't agree more that, and I say we, meaning kind of this industry, but, you know, we are not trying to tell anybody that we know better.
Right.
You know, and in fact, I've told some parents that where I can sense that feeling, and I've said, look, when my kids were younger, I said, look, you would probably have a better chance of getting my 8-year-old to go to bed tonight at 8 o'clock than I would, because at 8 years old, he already knew my buttons. And it was, you know, Dad, can you rub my back? Dad, can I have another glass of water? Dad, can I have milk? Dad, can I have this?
Yeah.
You know, so they already know the buttons. And so I try to explain to them that, you know, your child doesn't know our buttons. So we're not going in saying we know better. We're saying that we have an advantage because of that. But again, you're probably a great parent, and you could probably go in and help me with some things with my child.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of helps a little bit for them to understand that, okay, this isn't everybody saying I'm a big failure.
Well, and I really believe that.
Oh, absolutely.
I believe that these parents that are going to this extraordinary length to help their children or their child are among the best parents that exist. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're making extraordinary sacrifices. They've done everything that they know how to do and are at last saying, I need help. I need help to help my child. And I think that makes them incredible parents.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. And I know we're talking about success right now, high percentages and success. There is a question that parents do bring out, and they say, okay, what if my child completes the program and, in their terminology, relapses after returning home? How do you handle that? How does Sunhawk handle that?
It's an important question, and one of the key buzz phrases that's out there in addictions work is that relapse is a part of recovery. And to be real honest with you, Alan, I really don't like that phrase. It's like giving everybody permission. And that's my personal thing, and that's my personal hang-up. I don't like the phrase that relapse is a part of recovery. But unfortunately, it frequently is. And so because we recognize that, Sunhawk Adolescent Recovery Center is one of the very few, in fact, one of two that I'm aware of, centers that provides a guarantee that says that if this student completes the program, follows through on all the aftercare recommendations that we give, and if they relapse within the first year of completing the program, they can come back to Sunhawk for 45 days tuition free.
Nice.
And we will treat them at no tuition at Sunhawk for 45 days.
Now, and actually, I probably should have asked this earlier. How long is the program normally?
We're a program that doesn't predetermine the length of stay because it depends.
I tell the kids that all the time. It depends. Even when I know.
An average length of stay for a child to come in and complete the program is somewhere between 6 and 8 months.
Okay. Yeah, and actually that just reminded me as far as just another story, but I had a young man who, I don't want to make the story too long, but anyway, he didn't do well with being taken to the program before we were brought in. So we were brought in, but by that time he had already lost it. He'd already hurt some people, and so I was now picking him up from jail.
Right.
And his question to me was, how long is the program? Because he was now going to a much longer program than he was originally going to, and
right,
one with higher security. And I said my patented statement, it all depends on you.
Right.
And he looked at me and he said, look, I've been in 6 different programs. He goes, I know all the things that you're supposed to say. And I said, no, really, it does. Because if you go in with a bad attitude, it can take longer. And I went through all of my stuff and I thought I was doing great. And he goes, look. He goes, you've obviously done this a long time. He goes, this particular program that we're going to, he goes, of all the people that you've brought there, what's the shortest anybody's ever been there, and what's the longest anybody's ever been there? And I paused, and it was a particular program to where you could, the shortest that I knew of, and I prefaced it, and I said, understand, I go, they don't tell me all the time.
Right.
But of the ones that I'm aware of, I can think of one where the shortest was about 8 months, and I said, the longest for somebody was 22 months that I'm aware of. And he looked at me and he goes, well, at least you're honest.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, it was just the fact of, you know, he just felt like everybody was bullshitting him.
Mm-hmm.
And he got up and we walked out. We had no problem at all.
Right.
Because he said, you know what, at least you're honest. So,
yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, so that's why I'm saying, as soon as you started saying it depends, and I go, yeah, that's what we all say.
Yeah, that's what we all say.
But that's good, you know, for the parents at least to understand going in, you know, that if it's going to be about 8 months, plan for about 8 months. You know, if it's going to be 45 days to come back, you know, if something happens, you know, then they kind of have a feel for how long that's going to be and what you feel is needed to resolve it.
Most students can complete our program in 6 to 8 months.
Right. So, yeah, good to know. Now, let me, actually, I want to hit a few more things, and then I still want to talk about BACA a little bit.
Great.
But let me get a couple more things in regards to the program, and just other questions that I think parents or professionals may wonder, and that is, I mean, is the program equipped, you know, to address, like, dual diagnosis?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's part of where I come in and my department comes in. I believe that substance abuse is frequently, if not always, a secondary problem or
right.
starts out that way.
I'm with you.
It starts out as being a series of symptoms more than actual problems that then becomes a problem in and of itself. And I think that one of the shortcomings of a lot of treatment programs for substance abuse out there is that they just treat the substance abuse without the underlying issues. And so I believe that any effective substance abuse program has to be able to address dual diagnosis or the underlying issues behind the substance abuse. And so we do that. Now, in 6 to 8 months, you're not really going to be able to resolve all those issues. But I think where we excel is in being able to identify what those underlying issues are and really begin the treatment process for the dual diagnosis, for underlying mental illness conditions, underlying problems that might be there, and begin that treatment process and point the way toward further treatment.
Right. And actually what you're saying is also another reason why getting to the right program through an ed consultant or through a professional is important.
Absolutely.
Because you know, if you have a professional that is going to know these things, they're going to get this child to the right program. You know, and unfortunately, I mean, if you just hop on the internet, I mean, you may not necessarily know that a particular program can do this. You know, so again, having a professional, I think, is going to help a lot. Now, one of the other things I was thinking is that for those that obviously are at their computer, can you give us the website that they can go to, and they can actually be looking at some of the stuff that we're talking about right now for this program?
The website is www.sunhawkrecovery.com. It's a great website. You can get all kinds of information on there. And, of course, if anybody has any questions that the website doesn't answer, feel free to call us. We have a toll-free number. Trying to remember what the toll-free number is, and I don't see it right away, but we'll get that for you before the program's over.
Well, I mean, in this day and age, I don't even think that toll-free really matters anymore. I mean, is there a non-toll-free number that you have handy?
You're right about that. The non-toll-free number is 435, is the area code, 656-3211. We'll get you to the front desk, and any of us are happy to answer any questions. I personally, as the clinical director, would love to talk to anybody that has questions.
That would be great. Now, if I want to take a little break. When we come back, everybody hang in there. We're going to talk a little bit about BACA, which is Bikers Against Child Abuse. So, again, if you weren't able to write down that website, you can go to Answers, the numeral for the family. If you're driving out there, don't try to write and do this. But obviously, if you're logging in, you know what ours is. So go to ours and just shoot us an email that says we need a little more information on Sunhawk, and we will forward that to you. So we're going to take a break as I'm here working the board, and we will be back in about a minute. It's not coming through. Well, guess what? The commercial's not coming through, or at least I can't hear it from here. So let's go right into BACA. Now tell us a little bit about Bikers Against Child Abuse. And I know that most of these things, there are a certain amount of people out there that get a particular vision.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about the vision that people get and maybe why it's not completely accurate.
You know, one of the things that we get a lot of about Bikers Against Child Abuse and about BACA is that they mistakenly think, because of the image of bikers, and we are bikers, we are real bikers, we're not bike enthusiasts, we're the real thing, is that we're some vigilante group that's out there trying to get rid of the bad guys in the world. And we're certainly not opposed to the bad guys going away. But that's not what our mission is, and that's not what we're about. We're not a bunch of vigilantes, and we're not out there harassing child abusers. We're there for a whole different purpose, and it's an important distinction to make.
Well, I mean, just tell us a little bit about how BACA works.
Well, probably the best way to explain how BACA works is to go through the mission statement. Alan, you and
okay.
I talked about that before.
Absolutely. Tell us more about that.
You want me to read the mission statement?
That'd be perfect.
I can do that.
Okay.
Bikers Against Child Abuse, BACA, exists with the intent to create a safer environment for abused children. We exist as a body of bikers to empower children to not feel afraid of the world in which they live. We stand ready to lend support to our wounded friends by involving them with an established, united organization. We work in conjunction with local and state officials who are already in place to protect children. We desire to send a clear message to all involved with the abused child that this child is a part of our organization and that we are prepared to lend our physical and emotional support to them by affiliation and our physical presence. We stand at the ready to shield these children from further abuse. We do not condone the use of violence or physical force in any manner. However, if circumstances arise such that we are the only obstacle preventing a child from further abuse, we stand ready to be that obstacle.
You know, I've got a question that's kind of outside of it as far as the industry, but is BACA also getting involved now in some of the human trafficking issues?
If necessary to protect a child, we would. From a political standpoint, no, we don't. We're one of the things that separates us from other organizations that are out there for children is that we show up at the child's home. We're right mm-hmm. there. We're on the streets. We're in the child's front yard. We're at the school with them. We're in the courtroom with them. So we don't get involved in political issues. We don't campaign. We don't race. Well,
no, and I wasn't thinking just from a political standpoint. I was thinking actually more from the standpoint of one of the things that we do. I mean, is that we help get some of the kids off the streets that are involved in human trafficking. And as I was learning more about BACA, and I was thinking, you know, that might be great as additional help for us when we're going into a situation and we go, okay, look, we know based on our investigation that there's a particular location that is, that is using X amount of, 13, 14, and 15-year-old girls as slaves, or as sex slaves. So I was just wondering if you guys were also getting more involved in that. And I think we may actually need to talk more because I think you could probably help us.
When we become aware of a child or children that are being abused and they're afraid, we want to be involved. We will be involved.
Good.
In whatever that is. And so when that child is there and it needs our help, we will be there for that child.
That's great. That's great. And I know you guys, are you national or international?
We're actually international now. We started out in 1995, really got underway in 1996, started out just as a small group of bikers in Utah, and it has grown now to an international organization. We have several chapters in Australia and some chapters overseas that are starting and interest coming from all over the world. It's not easy to get a chapter going, and so it's a kind of a lengthy process.
How many members strong are you now?
I have no idea. But I can tell you it's thousands. We have, we're in, I believe it's 32, 34 states, something like that now. I think we have about 130 or 140 chapters organized around the world. I'm not sure exactly what the numbers are. One of the great challenges that we have as an organization is dealing with the growth that takes place.
Sounds like it's been huge.
My role is that of the National Clinical Advisor, and so I'm not involved with all the numbers and the chapter development, so I don't have exact numbers for what those are.
And then tell us a little bit about your role. That was actually one of my questions.
One of the things that we want to make sure of is that we do the right thing by each and every child that we come in contact with. And so the chapters are encouraged to have at their disposal a licensed mental health professional, somebody who is trained and licensed to work with children. In the event that a licensed mental health professional isn't available to a particular chapter, then they use me.
Okay.
If there's some situation that's confusing, they're not sure how to help a child, or if a child is appropriate for our care or something like that, then I would become involved in that.
Now, give us an example, I mean, just of a most typical situation that BACA gets involved in.
The main thing that we're looking for is a child who's afraid. Because our mission is to empower the child to not feel afraid of the world in which they live. And that's the thing that we're looking for, because what we want to do by our physical and emotional presence is to help this child not be afraid. Now, you think, for example, Alan, of a child who has been hurt mm-hmm. and is required to testify against the perpetrator, or the situation
right.
comes to that. Now, you and I both know that all too often it never even comes to that.
Exactly.
But in the situation where it does get to that point, you imagine, and all the listeners imagine for just a minute, being called into a courtroom where everybody in there is three or four times bigger than you. You're required to go into this sterile room that you've never been before to sit on a stand with somebody seated above you and next to you in a black robe with a hammer. We call them a gavel. They look mm-hmm. like a hammer.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy sitting right in front of you who is the perpetrator, who has threatened you, who has hurt you. And you're required to use a language that you're not really able to use and
right.
explain in a way that you're not able to use the most horrifying, embarrassing, shaming experience of your life while somebody else who's seated right next to the alleged perpetrator is trying to make you out to be a liar.
Mm-hmm.
And this person who has hurt you is glaring at you, seated right in front of you. Imagine that experience. Now imagine the same scenario, and seated right behind that perpetrator is a whole courtroom full of bikers who have been to your home, who have given you a vest that has a patch on it, who said, we're a part of your family now and you're a part of our family,
mm-hmm.
who you have come to believe because they showed up in your front yard loud,
mm-hmm.
who have given you a teddy bear that has a Baca shirt on it that says, we don't want you to be afraid. We're going to be there for you. We're going to show up for you, and we'll show up at court, and we'll take care of you. Wouldn't that make a difference to you if that courtroom was full of a bunch of ugly guys like me, all dressed in black leather, and a bunch of beautiful women like my wife that say, we're going to be there for you?
It's phenomenal. I mean, I just think it is phenomenal, because you are absolutely right. That is one of the most difficult situations for any, and it's almost as if they're being victimized all over again.
It's not almost as if
yeah.
they are.
Well, yeah, they are, but I'm saying almost in the sense that the only part that's not happening is the physical part.
Right.
But emotionally, right. yes.
Yeah, it really is traumatizing to the children to have to go through that process. And we're going to be there for the kids. If they're frightened in any situation, then we do whatever it takes to try to help that child not be afraid. And that's the key to this, Alan, is
mm-hmm.
that our mission, our purpose, is to help this child not be afraid of the world in which they live. I love the story of a child that we had at the courtroom one time that was seated there in the courtroom and started to fidget and fuss, and one of the bikers seated next to her said, what's the matter? And she says, I need to go to the bathroom. And they said, well, you can go to the bathroom. She said, no, I can't. How come? Because he's out there. And they said, oh, we can take care of that. And so a bunch of the brothers and sisters got up, formed a human barrier around her, a circle around her, which is important to note.
Oh, yeah.
That's our physical presence. And they escorted her out to the bathroom. Some of the sisters went in with her to the bathroom, took care of things, came back out, formed that human barrier between her and the alleged perpetrator, walked right in front of them. And as they returned to the courtroom, she stopped. She said, wait a minute. Squirmed between a couple of the bikers, stood in front of the perpetrator, and gave him the double bird.
Nice. Nice.
Flipped him off, both hands, right there in front of him. Got back inside the bikers and went back into the courtroom, and that's critical.
It's empowering.
Exactly. That's our mission, that then she wasn't afraid of him.
Right.
And she stood in front of the bikers with the bikers behind her, supporting her, to be able to do what she needed to do to say, I'm not afraid of you anymore. Then she can engage her therapy. Then she can engage whatever she needs to get better, to get strong, to get past what has taken place in her life, to be able to get healthy. That's what this is about. The children don't have to continue the nightmares. They don't have to continue living in fear. They can engage the trauma, and they can get past it therapeutically and in every other aspect of their life.
Yeah.
That's what we're about.
I love that. In fact, you know, as you were saying that, I'll give a visual, but I was getting horripilations on the back of my neck. And for those that don't know, that's when the little hairs stand up on the back of your neck. Just as you were saying that about her stepping out in front, you know, and the empowerment, you know, I could just feel the empowerment that she was getting at that particular moment. I think that's great. And actually, I think there's another positive aspect to it, is that it really is turning the tables. Because, you know, not only are you empowering that person, but I think you're taking away any power of that perpetrator.
You're absolutely right. And it goes around a lot that the prosecuting attorneys love us and the defense attorneys hate us and try to get us barred from the courtrooms frequently. And that's okay. We'll do what we need to do. If we need to stack our vests and patches outside the courtroom, then we'll do that. The kids know who we are because we've been there. And it doesn't matter what we wear. They know who we are, and we can fill the courtroom. If the judge says we can't be in the courtroom, we'll be lined up outside the courtroom. We'll do whatever we do, and that kid knows that we're right there.
Yeah. And by the way, we have judges and attorneys that are also on our mailing list that get this. For you judges out there, let them in.
Yeah.
Let them in. I mean, don't make this a situation, because you're potentially empowering the perpetrator by allowing his defense attorney to put people out of the courtroom. And the power is shifting in the wrong direction. It's been doing that for a long time. Let's put a stop to it.
I agree with you, Alan, and I understand very clearly constitutional rights and that, and I've had it explained to me by judges frequently. I understand the fear that the defense attorneys have of swaying at juries and things like that. I get that. I understand that. But I also understand that an adult has the ability to command a voice, to hire a voice to speak for him, and a child does not. A child doesn't have the words. A child doesn't have the language.
Right, but it's not, I mean, you guys aren't speaking out there.
Nope.
And that's the important thing to remember, is that we are empowering the child. So we're there. They know that we're there supporting them, believing in them, and that then they can speak and that they can be afraid and still do it. When we go to their home as the visits and the first time, a lot of them are unsure. They're adults. We're big and we're loud. And sometimes they're scared. They've been hurt. And so sometimes they stay back with mom and dad, or they don't want us to get too close. So it's really important that we are aware of, if they're stepping back, that we don't step forward.
Sure.
That then they are in control. Give them an opportunity to be in control. So we'll kneel down on their level. And if they are engaging, then we can say, can I give you a hug? Or would you like a hug? If they say no, say, oh, no problem. That's okay. And we back off. We let them run the show so that they can see that they are in charge.
Right.
And by doing that, they trust us, and they see that there's adults that can be trusted and that they can say what's going to go on. So that then when we go to court with them, they can say, will you please go to the bathroom with me? Or right. Will you sit there? Or can I look at you when I get scared? And so often they will look at us as things are going on during the court, so that they aren't having to look directly at the perpetrator.
Okay. Actually, the producer just came over and gave me the we're out of time signal behind you. Anyway, real quick, give us the website for BACA.
BACA is bacausa.com. I encourage your listeners to go on and see that. There's a lot of information that will help them a lot.
And thank you. I have more questions, but we're out of time. Thank you so much, both of you, for being here. And hopefully we can do this again.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Alan.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio.